Now we can see a new world coming into view. A world in which there is the very real prospect of a new world order.
The new world order does not mean surrendering our national sovereignty or forfeiting our interests.
How are you? Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in Southern California. Yeah, beautiful day here on the coast. And it is the 11th month, 13th day, 2017, Moon's Day, and we're ready to go. Are you? Pardon my hoarseness voice. I get it once in a while. Watched a damn good Western last night on Netflix. It's a Mexican film. Yeah, It makes Clint Eastwood's Western films look a little tame. I'll tell you, this was one it was one wild-ass movie. It's a long movie, too. And these Mexicans down there below the border, they got all these ranches and stuff, and they got kingpins, and they're killing off people. And they've got all these ranch helpers and people doing work for them, and they call them monkeys. They call them monkeys. Subtitles. Anyhow, it's called The Killer in Spanish. If you like that cold-blooded shit, that's the movie to watch, I'll tell you. I mentioned this to you. Another one that's interesting is a series called The Last Kingdom. It's the wars between the Danish Vikings and the English Saxons. Well, that's a wild-ass movie, too. Lots of heads chopped off. What do you think that the judge down there in Alabama is going to stay in the race? I have no use for hypocrites. I saw his interview with Sean Hannity, and he definitely let the cat out of the bag. He didn't do himself any good, I'll tell you that. Right wing thinks they got a problem with infiltrators and snitches and all that. Go back to medieval England there, the Danes and the Danish Vikings and the Saxons fighting each other. Everybody's squealing on everybody, screwing everybody, literally. Anyhow, when the Saxons and the Vikings got it on, boy, the blood flew, I'm telling you. It's something else, about like a South Chicago street fight. Well, the webmaster sent me a little something. She said I should play on here, so we're going to do it right now.
Would you consider yourself a New Yorker, Dr. Michael Hudson?
Absolutely not. I've never felt comfortable in New York. I was born in Minneapolis, and when my father got out of jail, we moved to Chicago, and I grew up there.
Whoa. When your father got out of jail, what?
He was one of the Minneapolis 17 sent up the day before Pearl Harbor for advocating the advocacy of the overthrow of the government by force and violence, which meant that he was organizing the Teamsters Union. And the Roosevelt administration made a deal with Dan Tobin to turn the Teamsters Union over to the mob. And apparently there was a deal with the Russians that if the government would throw the Minneapolis Trotskyists in jail, and Minneapolis was the only city in the world where being a Trotskyist was a career advancement opportunity, that they promised not to have strikes during World War II. So the Stalinists were calling for the death penalty against the Smith Act that later was used against them after World War II. So at any rate, my father was one of the Minneapolis 17, and then we moved to Chicago. I love Chicago. I still think of that as my basic city. And when I think of which direction I'm in, I still act as if the Hudson River is Lake Michigan, and except that that's on the west instead of the east, so I'm always turning
okay,
around.
Now, we were just in Minneapolis, and I did a little reading up on this city. So it is on the top of the river there, the
Mississippi
River. It's at the very top, and it made its bones on processing milling flour. And they created bleached flour, which then they ran into trouble with the bleached flour. It was determined scientifically that bleached flour was no good for you, and the people came in with the full the flour with the full
not the whole grain,
the whole grain flour, right. And so what was the labor conditions like at that time? Because obviously that story plays into it, right? I mean,
Minneapolis was a center of labor history in the 1930s.
Okay,
you had a general strike there in 1934, 1936. There's a book about that, Charles Rumford Walker's American City, that describes it. You had the whole general strike, and that became, as I said, the only Trotskyist city in the world.
So this is in the Depression, essentially.
Yes.
And you had the Wall Street blow up and the 29 crash, and you quickly entered into the Depression. And Trotskyists and communists and other forms of governments and economics other than capitalism were in the ascent, because it was considered the Wall Street was a collapse of the capitalist ideal. So you had these competing schools suddenly in America, and it gave rise to ardent anti-communists. We saw McCarthy in the 50s. That's really a holdover from that period, correct? And we saw, Reagan was also out of that school of fighting the communists. You know, he built a huge political career on it. But from there, was there much of an organized labor in America before then?
Of course, from the late 19th century on. Eugene Debs, the socialists, but the center of labor organization was in the Midwest because that's where the manufacturing was. It happened that in Minneapolis, because it's not very populated, the truckers were the big industry there. There was a lot of violence. You had Floyd B. Olson, who was the governor, who said he hoped the capitalist system goes right to hell, and so he was reelected as governor. It was all destroyed when the right wing came in, led by Hubert Humphrey on the far right.
Right. That's exactly right. And that was his path to the presidency, I guess, right?
To show that he was a good double-crosser. He was sort of an early Obama type, speak left and then slam down with him very hard on the right.
Right. So this is a fascinating piece of American history. So so Minneapolis is an undertold story, I would say. People are familiar with Chicago and what happened in the 30s, obviously organized crime. People know the history of organized labor in New York and the longshoremen. And, of course, organized labor then became corrupt, didn't it? It was infiltrated by the mafia, essentially.
That was largely Roosevelt's doing, and it was done because of his fight against the Teamsters in Minneapolis.
Right.
He wanted the only alternative to having the socialists organize the labor unions was to have the mafia organize the labor unions by saying, if you're the head of the labor unions, you get to say who's hired, you get the kickbacks, you get everything that Bob Fitch wrote about in his study of the labor movement. So it's very much like in Japan, when America backed the Yakuza against the socialists. Japan had a very strong socialist movement. MacArthur came in, backed all of the most right-wing militarist Japanese, and the gangs, the Yakuza gangs, to fight against socialists, and that's why you have Japan in the sorry state that it's in today when it comes to industrial honesty and the steel mills.
So it's an interesting period of fulcrum, you know, the 30s and seemingly in Minneapolis. I mean, okay, there's organized labor before, but then it became a threat in a big way because the capital system was collapsing. I mean, I guess before then it was more of an adjunct to the overall economy where, okay, we're going to organize labor. They invented the weekend, for example, organized labor. Without the organized labor, we would have no weekend.
That's right.
And we have no Hollywood. We have no entertainment industry. We have no theme parks. You know, we have no vacations. You know, it's a huge part of the economy of America was invented in effect by labor. And then in the 30s, post crash, you know, it really became more politicized in that sense. So did the labor organizers at that point, were they always referring back to a Leninist Marxist reference?
No, not at any point. Remember, Minneapolis is very largely Scandinavian. So you had a lot of Scandinavians there. In New York, you'd have basically Central Europeans and Jews organizing the garment trades and the labor unions. But in Minneapolis, you had a completely different ethnicity with a different national background. And they had a kind of Scandinavian sense of fair play. My father said that who graduated from the University of Minnesota with an MBA, he said it was the Rover Boys stories that gave him a sense of fair play. And the American boy stories of the early 1900s.
Horatio Alger?
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Or does that come later?
That same idea of everybody being fair and kind of how little kids would play with each
Norman
other.
Norman Rockwell depiction of America.
Well, except he was a Stalinist. So
Rockwell?
Yeah.
Was a Stalinist?
Yes.
What?
Yes. You didn't know that he was one of their funders? That's the irony.
I'm learning
of the thing.
Things here today that are shocking. What? So anyway, to get back to the narrative here. So the 30s. So and what was there an individual, a person, where labor in America suddenly did start to overtly reference Marxist-Leninist doctrine?
Not really, you
except
know.
Except your dad.
No, when I was, even my father. When I was a little kid, I would my father would take me over to the houses of a lot of leaders, including people who were on the Central Committee of the Comintern when Lenin was in power. And being I was maybe 8 or 9 years old, and I'd always look at the library, and they always had Marx's Capital in the library. And I'd always go and look at, you know, open it up, and nobody had ever read a single, they'd never been opened before, especially volumes 2 and 3 had never been opened. Volume 1 maybe, but not volumes 2 and 3. So the fact is, they had them on the shelves, but they didn't read it.
So now your career took you through Wall Street. You were a credit analyst for Chase Manhattan Bank.
Well, just about
right?
Who else was going to be an economist on Wall Street except a Marxist?
Tell me more. Why would you say such a thing?
Well, you know that it's all about exploitation. And if you go to a business school and you think everything's fair and you don't understand that it's about exploitation and crooks and you know how the system works. The Marxists being outsiders, we could look at the system, and of course we were the forward planners and the futurists, because we were looking at how society would change. And the business schools would tell people there's not going to be any change. Everything's going to go just the way it is. That's what we call equilibrium. And we Marxists were always looking at disequilibrium. So we could, of course, forecast all of
But you were analyzing the credit in terms of how effectively it could be extractive.
I was saying how much could be extracted and at what point will the break come, and that's certainly all Volume 3 of Capital. That credit, as Marx pointed out, interest-bearing debt grows exponentially, but the economy only grows on an S-curve and tapers off. So every economy creates debt faster than the ability to pay, and that's where the break is.
So Marx is a quintessential critic of capitalism.
Yes,
is that a fair statement?
That's why he called his book Capital.
Right. So as a philosophy, it's not really presenting a political construct, although many have chosen to use it as such.
He looked at the laws of motion. So it's not a construct as a single building. It's the law of motion. It's a river.
So where have communist countries gone wrong? Because, you know, people have tried to adopt systems that were the antithesis of capitalism or different than capitalism. So far, we haven't seen many succeed. What's going wrong there?
Well, right after Lenin died, Stalin killed everybody who'd read Marx.
Oh, okay. So that was the kibosh on things.
Since the 1920s, Russia has knew nothing about Marxism, and it was the
first.
It's
been tried elsewhere. All over the world
has
been tried. You mean, it's been tried in other countries, other hemispheres, other places.
Marxism, in a way? I don't really think so. I mean, certainly
socialism?
Socialism is a step towards it, and everybody.
What are they getting wrong, though? In other words, my question is, what would, if you were starting a country today, convert America to a different system? Because obviously the system now is extractive, it's compounding the debt ad infinitum, and it's causing huge wealth and income gaps, and it's not working in many different ways. And so if you were to come back, and you're a Marxist scholar, effectively, you know, what would be a couple of the points that would build, a sustainable economy?
That what is stifling the economy today is finance, and it's the growth of debt, and it's the inability of debt to pay that is leading to a huge transfer of property.
Which would lead to, let's say, the MTM theory? Monetary theory?
Yes.
Is that the solution in your book?
Yes, but I go beyond most of the MMTers, because I divide the private sector into the fire sector, the finance, insurance, and real estate, as opposed to the industrial.
So we've got about a
economy.
Minute. So just describe MMT. And that's a huge out of the school in Kansas City.
Yes.
Is you find the MMT people like yourself. Bill Black, I think, is there.
Yeah, Marshall Auerbach.
Marshall Auerbach, he's in that, too?
He's at the Bard Bard.
Who's that lovely woman?
Levy Institute.
Who's always talking about it?
Stephanie Kelton.
Stephanie Kelton, she's in this. So in 30 seconds, kind of break it down for us what it is.
That banks or the government create money simply electronically. It's not a thing. Money is debt. And the way that you create money into the economy is create debt by one party to another. If the government spends money into the economy, it spends it directly on infrastructure, on hiring goods and service, hiring labor to produce something
so
real.
So the government creates money not like a central bank that lends it to the government.
It could. No,
doesn't make any difference.
The Treasury,
no interest bearing.
Essentially, the Treasury used to be the central bank. The Federal Reserve broke the Treasury off to put money creation in the hands of Wall Street.
So get rid of that. We go back
put the Treasury in control once again.
Right.
The Treasury would issue money. But if you leave money creation to the banks, endogenous money, as Steve Keen, who you often have said, the banks lend money only, they don't lend money to spend on goods and services. They lend money for corporate takeovers, to inflate real estate prices. So government money creation is different purpose from private bank money creation.
Okay, we've got to leave it there, Dr. Michael Hudson. Thank you. Well, that's going
to
do it for this.
Well, this takes me back quite a ways to the very early 60s. When I was going around, I was invited to some of these get-togethers like Willis Carto and Liberty Lobby were putting together. So right up here in L.A., I gave a couple of speeches on debt money. And got along with almost everybody except Willis Carto, when he was parading Willis Stone, I think it was Willis Stone, his name was Stone, who had come up with the Liberty Amendment. And I told him the Liberty Amendment's full of baloney. It's no good. He was saying we want to get the government, we want to get out of the banking, the Federal Reserve, out of the federal government. I said, you dumbasses, it isn't owned by the federal government. That's a problem. It should have been owned by the federal government. The Federal Reserve System was privately owned and incorporated in about 10 different districts. And they didn't like to hear that. And I went to the American Independent Party Convention in Sacramento, and I spoke out against the Liberty Amendment there. I said, Willis Stone is full of prunes, and I think he was probably a Jew. He even looked like a Jew. And so I debated this in the banking committee, and I defeated it, and they threw it out. But then they went down to the floor, and they put it back. Willis Carto strong-armed it back in, the Liberty Amendment. And at that point, seeing the fix was in, I walked out of the convention and quit the party. Went across the street, had a cocktail at a bar, and a reporter came in. He said, what did you leave for? I said, look, they're just as bad as the Republicans and the Democrats, and that's why I've got my antipathy towards all these parties. They all go rotten. They all get corrupt and like that. Now, that's funny. Now, Willis Carto, he was supporting and putting a lot of money behind Willis Stone and his Liberty Amendment, but it would have just made sure that the Federal Reserve stayed in private hands, which it has stayed in private hands. That's a little bit of history about that. The reason for that is to maintain the debt money system. They must maintain the debt money system. And now we're almost, or at least a long way towards the end of the trail. I mean, the whole money apparatus is a debt system, and you have no functional, really, government at all. These are all just actors on a stage playing a part. Back then, at the turn of the last century, the socialists, and they were running high. They were riding high on the horse, man, and they were doing some good stuff about labor. And even the Ku Klux Klan was backing socialist politicians in the Minnesota, Wisconsin area. Several of the mayors were socialists and so forth. And of course, Jack London was one of the most famous socialists. And most of the Socialist Party voted and fought to keep out of World War I. They finally entered into it, but earlier on, Jack London switched over to supporting World War I, which is one of the only fallacies and problems I see with Jack London. Saturday night, me and my main squeeze and I went to a Doors concert. These are the people who imitate famous bands and musicians, and what a hell of a concert that was of the Doors, with about 200 people dancing in the aisles, most of them over 40. What a time was had by all, and they had booze too.
You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there.
I gained my respect for the Doors by watching Apocalypse Now, the movie. I must have watched that at least a half a dozen times. It's about time to go back and watch it again. I think that was the film that put the hook into me about anti-war, because I don't think up until that time I'd been too much anti-war, but that movie brought it out. And Platoon, too. Do you remember Winds of War with Robert Mitchum? You remember Robert Mitchum? Yeah, he was quite a famous actor in Hollywood. And most of you who are a little older remember him. Here's a little thing I dug out you might be interested in. Robert Mitchum's uncensored statement on the Jews. This appeared in Esquire magazine back in February of 83. Quote, I had met Harry Cohen, the late Columbia Pictures mogul. Once after a dinner, I had said to him, "You don't seem like such a prick to me," Cohen said. "Wait till you work with me." So then when Columbia came buzzing around with About Eternity, another movie, we had secret meetings, and I put a petition to RKO. I called Howard Hughes, and he said, "Jesus Christ, Bob, that's being done by those people up the street, isn't it? All those Jews. You don't want to be associated with those people." So later I walked into Romanoff's for lunch, and Harry Cohen was sitting there. He calls me chicken. I said, "I tried." He says, "You tried." Quote, I think it's time for the United States to stop trying to win an international popularity contest, and if surgery is indicated, cut. I couldn't argue with him. You have a melanoma, you remove it, or else the flesh around it suffers. I ask about moral principles. Quote, you can design a moral principle for rape if you're so inclined, as Hitler did. Quote, Hitler needed Lebensraum. Unquote. And the slaughter of 6 million Jews, question mark? So the Jews say. So the Jews say. I don't know. People dispute that. Well, they've kind of got me in a corner, and he says without looking at me, because both Winds of War and this show think it's important. It's important to them. His arms fly up in the air again. It hasn't got a thing to do with me. It rakes me. It takes me, takes up my time, and the only thing I'm working for is time off. But you do it for her, Seasons publicist, because she has a job to do. He pauses, then resumes his stare at me. Like Eichmann said, "It's my job." There is a pause, and I change the subject. Then a while later, he returns to it. Quote, "We had a bunch of us that were going to go to Israel and wear big buttons saying, 'I like Ike.' See how that goes across." There is yet another well-timed pause, another change of the subject, and then he zeroes in for what appears to be the kill. "How do you say, 'trust me,' in Jewish?" he asks. His answer, "You." Yeah, they got all over Mitchum for that. Pretty much wiped out his career. Well, now I'm going to read you a little story about the intrepid liar. And this was by Revelo P. Oliver. When the wealthy Sir William Stephenson died in his luxurious home on Bermuda at the age of 93, he lived up to his reputation as the very modest and retiring man. He wished to die unnoticed by the world, and accordingly arranged to have his death and funeral kept strictly secret until after he had been buried. The surest way to attract the attention of the press throughout the world. The newspapers in Britain, Canada, and the United States, and no doubt in many other countries, blossomed with obituaries. The Chicago Tribune, for example, lauded him as the great spymaster, the man who resolutely took on Hitler and the Nazis, and whose work in the British intelligence was decisive in the fight against the Nazis, and surely a man who was thus responsible for the defeat of Germany, the destruction of the British Empire and the ruin of the United States, and the fall of Western civilization, deserved the most fulsome plaudits a hack writer could devise. When I read that obituary, I laughed sardonically. Upon a dozen years ago, I picked up a book about Sir William's career in espionage entitled A Man Called Intrepid. I read 80 or 90 pages before I threw it aside because I had no time for crude fiction. I thought it likely that Sir William had written it himself, and that the journalist whose name appeared as the author was just part of the hoax. Now let me hasten to add that Sir William undoubtedly knew by long and practical experience by far, far more about intelligence work than I do. But let me suggest an analogy. My knowledge of chemistry is little more than what I learned in school, where in those far-off days one verified empirically in the laboratory most of what one was taught. I went only so far as the second year. But nevertheless, it's a distinguished chemist and a holder of a Nobel Prize were to assert that there is no hydrogen in water, which is a compound of nitrogen and helium, I would know at once that he lied thrice, and so reckless a disregard of facts as to make all his other statements suspect. The trouble had not pulled out all the stops on the calliope. That was done by Sunday Times London, which described the late Sir William as the giant of the century, asseverating that no one excepting possibly Churchill had done more than he had to win the war. If I may borrow a metaphor from the eminent British historian Hugh Trevor Roper, the newspapers in their encomia of the great Sir William merely regurgitated the tripe they had swallowed years before. Professor Trevor Roper, in the Sunday Telegraph, London, February 19, 1989, used the weight of his authority, as should have been necessary, to expose definitely the crude imposture, and he did so judiciously, admitting that Sir William was really entitled to no little credit for work he had actually done as an operative of the British Secret Service. I've often alluded to the important and sometimes crucial work of the secret services of both civilized and barbarous nations, and in Liberty Bell, January 1988, under the rubric "The Business of Deception," I explained why intelligence agencies sometimes by necessity and sometimes from mere habit deceive even the nations of whom they're working. The career of Sir William is relevant to that subject and is otherwise significant. He was a Canadian, son of a prosperous owner of a lumber mill. He served honorably in the British Army's Air Force in the First World War and was decorated for his services. After that war and until 1939, he promoted numerous corporations and similar financial enterprises in Britain, always with great profit to himself, and one supposes also with profit to the stockholders or participants in limited partnerships. He became a well-known and very wealthy man. His prominence as a businessman and financier gave him a cover that made him the obvious choice when he was enlisted by the British military intelligence to take charge of British espionage and sabotage in the United States, which he directed from an office in New York that was later made famous under the name Room 3603. What American acquaintance would believe that the affable but pedestrian and rather dull English businessman was really the director of a branch of what was, among the civilized nations, the most cunning and ruthless secret service in the world, excelled only by the Jews. He was doubtless given assistance, experienced in espionage, sabotage, and subversion, and profited from their instruction and advice. But much of the agency's success must be credited to his own lucid mind. He won the admiration and loyalty of his operatives, if the testimony of two or three of them is to be trusted, and if, as one may suspect, his imagination provided some of the exploits of which he told them that could be attributed to a technique of inspirational management. The espionage, sabotage, and subversion in the United States was principally directed against Americans who were ostensibly refusing to be shipped to Europe as cannon fodder to rescue Britain from the insane war on which they had embarked on behalf of the Jews and their Soviet empire. But he also discreetly kept under surveillance Roosevelt's government to make certain that the perfidious criminal would keep his promises when he could. Only a small part of what Stephenson's branch of the British Secret Service accomplished in the United States has been disclosed in the book about it. There can be no doubt, but he did make a large contribution to the vast complex of forces that brought about the suicide of the West. After Roosevelt succeeded in using the Japanese to give himself dictatorial powers to herd millions of Americans abroad to fight and die for the benefit of their enemies, Stephenson, whose illegal activities had been only reluctantly tolerated by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, affiliated himself with the mushroom organization headed by the madcap and unscrupulous Wild Bill Donovan, and known as the OSS, an abbreviation which the old-line American intelligence services translated as Office of Soviet Stooges. It was a bizarre organization. One of its principal purposes was to provide a secure refuge for Jews and others whose valuable hides must not be exposed to a risk of abrasion. It maintained a hive of big brains who turned out very secret reports, many of which were ludicrous. I rather vaguely remember one by a psychiatrist who had been morbidly fascinated by the way in which Japanese children are housebroken, and deduced from it that the Americans, after their victory, must be careful not to humiliate the Japanese or bruise their delicate souls by letting them know that they had been defeated. It did mount operations abroad during the war, some of which had a limited success. It included, of course, many well-meaning but rather naive individuals. There was, for an example, the American major who, with two sergeants, was sent by plane to deliver a supply of weapons to supposedly patriotic Italian partisans who were harassing the Germans. The two sergeants, who were communist agents, murdered the major and delivered the arms to the Italian communists, who were plotting to make Italy part of the Soviet Empire. Stephenson probably had a well-dissembled contempt for the staff of the OSS, but he basked in the unlimited admiration which was accorded to him as a spymaster, although so far as is known, he only transmitted to them information from his superiors which they permitted him to communicate to that strange American operation. And he did work closely with the OSS, although British military intelligence knew better than to trust Donovan's madhouse until he was recalled about a year before the end of the war, possibly at his own suggestion. After the war, Stevenson was knighted in recognition of his services, and then with his old pal Donovan and others, he embarked on business ventures, making it possible by catastrophe, which were highly profitable to him and made him more wealthy than ever. Donovan and others, who had been connected with the Office of Soviet Stooges, lavished praise on Sir William for his supposed genius in secret work, and the Canadian press, for some obscure reason of its own, made him the national hero of Canada. Virtually all the universities in Canada showered honorary degrees upon him, and ambitious Canadian politicians boasted that they had once had the great privilege of meeting him. That may have inspired him. In 1960, Sir William subsidized H. Montgomery Hyde, a British writer who had served him in New York, to produce a biography entitled Quiet Canadian. I have not seen the book, but its fashioned the specious legend of Sir William was so extremely modest and retiring a man that he did not want to talk about his great exploits during the war. Hyde is a really expert professional writer who has turned out so many books on every conceivable subject, and he thought would yield large sales and royalties, that he suspects that if I were to compile a list of all the publications, it would fill a page of Liberty Bell, and perhaps run over to the following one. For his next effort at spectacular modesty, Sir William turned again to H. Montgomery Hyde, who typed out a chronicle of his great achievements as a British agent in the United States, entitled Room 3603, published in 1962. In that very successful book, Hyde narrates his own experiences in Stevenson's organization, and I'm willing to suppose that this rather minor part of the book does not depart too greatly from the truth. For the rest, Hyde was depended on and naturally accepted what the modest Sir William told him about international affairs and his role in them. The account in Room 3603 is not absolutely correct, incredible, if you make allowances for the chronic habit of deception in intelligence agencies, on which I comment in Liberty Bell. For example, the heads of the British military intelligence probably told the highest officials of their government in utmost secrecy that the talents of a beautiful female spy in bed had sufficed to extract the Italian naval code from a high-ranking Italian officer. They thus concealed in a way which their ability to read that code had actually been obtained. Furthermore, if the spurious secret was kept, well and good. If it somehow leaked to the Italian intelligence, the Italians would thereupon suspect in turn all the officers who would have betrayed their country and sold the code for sexual favors, and thus demoralize all of them. Long after the war and the necessity for secrecy had passed, it is quite likely that ranking British officers repeated the canard from a habit or because they knew no better. I gave an American an example of this article I mentioned above. Thus, a reader who read the story about the beautiful and erotically talented spy in room 3603 would, even if they knew the facts, assume that Sir William had merely repeated the cover story. In 1965, Hyde, with the cordial cooperation of Sir William, produced what may be his finest book, a bestseller entitled Cynthia. When I read it, I considered the hypothesis that the book was a hoax and that 7 of the 8 photographs in it had been posed by hired actors. The 8th could have been taken from some hook on French geography or history. It seems, however, that the female spy who is the subject of the book actually existed. A friend of mine in Minneapolis verified one essential detail for me, and Professor Trevor Roper, who unfortunately seems not to have seen the book, assumed that it was at least in large part truthful. Cynthia was the sobriety quiet code name for a beautiful British spy, a well-known, well-born American girl, Amy Elizabeth Thorpe, born in Minneapolis and born with a lust to become a heroic adventuress. An ambition she eventually realized after she had been imbued with the horror stories about Hitler and the wicked Nazis with which the Jews filled the press they controlled before, during the Second World War. She may have welcomed an opportunity to consider her lovely body as an expendable as any soldiers in the line of duty, on behalf of what she credulously thought a noble cause instead of a project for universal ruin. Cynthia is a moving book, for it is written with deep emotion. Hyde was unmistakably in love with Cynthia and had been her lover, with or without the knowledge of her two successful husbands. On several occasions, the last not long before her untimely and agonizing death from cancer, which touched him deeply. One hopes that most of the story which Hyde attributes to Cynthia herself was substantially true. There is at least one episode which cannot be truthfully reported as it stands, but if we assume that Hyde did not invent it and foist it on Cynthia, a man who gallantly wishes to champion the beautiful young woman can form a plausible hypothesis that what Cynthia told Hyde was misunderstood in terms of what he had heard from Sir William. Hyde probably wrote room 3603 in good faith, not taking the time to ponder the inconsistencies and improbabilities in Sir William's stories, for he was simultaneously working on a book on a totally different subject. But he must have had his misgivings, for he refused to carry out Sir William's next project in ostentatious modesty. As I have said, after glancing at the man called Intrepid, and of course there was a movie made about this, I decided that Sir William, who signed a preface reluctantly certifying the accuracy of the story, a pertinacious journalist had coaxed from him, probably wrote the whole tale himself, perhaps in competition with Ian Fleming, whose novels about spies were enjoying great and lucrative popularity. According to Professor Trevor Roper, however, I was mistaken about that, and the journalist who took responsibility for the book actually existed and may be alive today. A man called Intrepid, which could have been more accurately entitled Four Flusher Who Calls Himself Intrepid, was the payoff. As I have said, even with my limited knowledge of such matters, I discarded the book in disgust after inspecting with growing incredulity first glance of the baloney. Professor Trevor Roper remarks in the book, is a work of such blatant absurdity that it ought to have sunk author and subject for good. Sir William's megalomania had progressed to the point of which he made himself the alter ego of Winston Churchill and co-director of Britain's part of the war, superior to the British cabinet and to all the officers of the Royal Navy, Army, and Navy. According to Trevor Roper, in a part of the book he did not have the fortitude to read, Sir William decided he had invented television and the jet aircraft, first produced by Messerschmitt for the German Air Force. And this singularly modest man, who shunned publicity, in the words of his journalist stooge, forged photographed a letter from grateful Winston Churchill to himself, forged it so crudely that it was almost patently spurious. And he made his book many claims that are outrageous, not only for the effrontery of his mendacity, but because he could not rationalize the effrontery, his mendacity, but because he had not rationally have hoped that they would not be detected and exposed. The British professor gives one example. Sir William claimed to have trained in Canada a team of assassins who he then dispatched by parachute into Czechoslovakia to assassinate the celebrated Reinhard Heydrich der Henker. One of the cowardly assassins who lived in Canada read the book, knew where he and his accomplice had been trained and by whom, and did not hesitate to denounce the lie by a man of whom he had not before heard. This was but one of the many examples. Sir William was not perturbed by the fact that, as a professor, Trevor Roper says, the book, one of the most ludicrous works ever written on the subject, was promptly torn to shreds by those who knew the facts, or could read the documents, or could distinguish sense from nonsense. To all the questions, Sir William blandly replied, and he could not discuss such matters without risk of revealing even more profound and world-shaking secrets he was guarding and violated his bosom. And he even had the astounding temerity to hire his tamed journalist to take responsibility for an even more blatant absurd book, Intrepid's Last Case, from 1981. Sir William's impudent mendacity was publicized publicly and indubitably exposed many times, but amazingly he continued to enjoy the fictitious honors he had created for himself. In 1983, 2 years after the publication of a book that put the Baron von Munchausen to shame, he came to New York to receive the William J. Donovan Award for Services to Democracy and Freedom. At a great grand banquet attended by 800 well-heeled suckers, where he received a personal message from Ronnie Reagan, who shamelessly averred that he and all freedom-loving men in the world have a special place in our hearts and minds and our history books for the man called Intrepid, unquote. There could be no more conclusive demonstration of the density of the mephitic fog of lies in which the Aryan world was lived and groped since 1945 as the Jews enforced their pseudo-legal terrorism, respect for rank and increment of their preposterous holohokes, hordes of thieves and parasites dominate the political politics of all nations of the Western world, and the venal educators inject fraudulent history and the deadly one-world pus into the minds of the hapless and helpless children that befuddled parents voluntarily send to tax-supported booby hatches. The impudent hoaxer who claimed to have defeated the wickedly sane Nazi, so dear to the malignant scum that rules us, that knowing him to be a liar, they continued to believe him. What is more, Sir Williams knew that they would believe him, no matter how preposterous the lies he told. They had to. He was keeping inviolate in his bosom deep dark secrets about many of the dirtiest and most scandalous, scabulous crimes they had to conceal. His references to such secrets, when asked about his wilder tales, was a polite threat. Denounce my lies and I will tell the truth. A man of his experience in intelligence work must have known that everything the general public is told about the Second World War by the several governments and by the press in each Western nation and is rammed into the minds of the children as history is simply a vast spider web of lies and flagitious deceit, from the Jews' gigantic holohawks to the reported character and actions of the great war criminals Roosevelt, Churchill, to even quite minor matters such as trivial incidents on the battlefield or the content of now forgotten books. The dense miasma of lies conceals the putrescence of democracy and social justice, and the abomination of politicians who feed on their nations as worms feed on buried corpses. In a world of lies, Sir William amused himself by imitating with covert sarcasm and parody, and thus subtly mocking the elected leaders and champions of democracy in Washington, London, Bonn, and Paris. And I, for one, believe he did more than amuse himself. Sir William did well to use his death as the last means of calling attention to himself. He was a great man, and he fully deserved the praise that was lavished upon him, although for quite different reasons. I misjudged him when I contemptuously tossed aside a man called interpreter, and assumed that Sir William was merely profiting from the ignorance and gullibility of persons whose knowledge of intelligence services was limited to novels by Eric Ambler and his successors. It was only when he received the Donovan Award that I understood what he had done and had began to admire the intrepid liar. Every person who has served in the intelligence work about the level of clerical task or routine assignments knows the truth about at least one incident that is sufficient to make him perceive the enormity of the whole intricate web of lies that is used to enslave our people. He may acquiesce to the gigantic fraud because he accepts with military discipline the alleged raison d'etat, or because he himself approves of the subjection of mankind to Judeo-communism, or because he is unwilling to take the risk of giving the lie to the masters of the world, or because he knows he would not be believed by the victims if they told them the truth. Sir William must have known that if he began to expose the rulers of the world, he would be murdered without a compunction or delay. He chose the only safe way to tell the truth to men who could understand. He told enormous and flagrant lies, which the masters of deceit had to pretend they believed. The Donovan Award and the accompanying adulation was his moment of triumph that sealed the record that tells an intelligent historian all that he needs to know to direct properly his research in the archives from which it was not possible to delete all the vestiges of the truth. And any thinking man who pretends that Sir William has done will arrive at a working knowledge of the truth for himself. But despite every effort that may be made to disclose historical facts, the Aryan suckers who are the victims of organized crime will doubtless continue to relish the swill that their owners dump into their troughs. They have been taught to love their enemies. The well-known axiom must be rephrased: those whom the Jews would destroy, they first make mad. And that's the end of my reading. In other words, this guy sort of outsmarted him. He told monstrous lies, covering up the truth, but the truth was underneath. The lies were so crazy that any real sharp historian could find out the lies sooner or later. That's pretty cool. Well, what did you think of Veterans Day? How about that? Wasn't that something? I couldn't get over how many people are walking around on the streets saying thank you for your service, not knowing anything about the service. I had an army hat I wore around a little bit, and I had people coming up almost in tears thanking me for my service, even though I only spent 3 years in the military in a cushy job in Europe. But anyhow, they're really talking this stuff up. Thank you for your service. Oh, and they're getting all misty-eyed, too. I couldn't believe it. They're promoting that now. As if all these guys, almost all of them were in support services. They never saw battle or never were in the foxhole at all. And those kind of guys usually keep their mouth shut and don't talk too much. They're so pissed off about the whole thing. So anyhow, they're really building this up. It's a, you saved the country, you saved freedom, you did this wonderful thing, and it's nauseating. It is really nauseating. If you know anything about the truth of the crap, the military-industrial complex has just enslaved the whole Western world. Nothing but white niggers that every time they blow the horn, you run out and say, oh, I want to be in on that. I want to be in on that. It's just like all they had to do was knock down the World Trade Center. And boy, I'll tell you, that's good for another 75 years of warfare. Well, anyhow, that's the way it goes. I'll see you tomorrow. Tears Day. Oh, another thing, if you really want them following you around like a rock star, wear a military hat and put a neck brace on, one of those donuts you put around your neck, which I have to do once in a while. But that convinces them you were on the front lines, man.